Welcome to Radio Free Albion with Tony Trigilio. My guest today is Lina Ramona Vitkauskas. I'll be talking with Lina about her newest book, A Neon Tryst, published in 2013 by Shearsman Books. Welcome to Radio Free Albion. This is Tony Trigilio, and I'm talking today via Skype with Lina Ramona Vitkauskas. Lina Ramona Vitkauskas is the author of the epic poem Spiny Retinas, forthcoming from Mutable Sound in 2014, A Neon Tryst, which just came out in 2013 from Shearsman Books, Honey is a She, which was published by Plastique Press in 2012, The Range of Your Amazing Nothing, which came out with Ravenna Press in 2010, and Failed Star Spawns Planet / Star, Dancing Girl Press, 2006. Her past and forthcoming publications include work in Coconut, Tarpaulin Sky, Diagram, Triquarterly, the Chicago Review, and the Toronto Quarterly, among many others. She's the marketing director of the Chicago School of Poetics and co-editor of the 14-year-running online literary journal Milk Magazine. Hello, Lina. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I am excellent. It's great to have you on the show.
Yes, it's good to be here.
And you know, as I was reading your bio, I couldn't help but think, your book titles are just amazing. You know, I mean, like, you've got, I just want to say Spiny Retinas over and over again and see, like, it's like some kind of magic spell, you know?
Yeah, it is mantra-like, isn't it? I just, I really enjoy putting different words together. And that one of my favorite things to do is put together titles and book names and so forth. I'm always coming up with new band names, too.
Oh, Spiny Retinas would be a great band name.
Wouldn't it? Yeah.
Like, it'd be like an excellent sort of like a neo-hardcore punk name. But we have millions and trillions of listeners out there in many worlds in Radio Free Albion. And somewhere in some world, there's someone who plays in a hardcore punk band who's stealing that name right now.
Oh, totally. I guarantee somebody's taken it.
And that's absolutely flattering.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, you know, later I'd like us to hear a little bit more about the forthcoming book, Spiny Retinas. But for now, let's talk about A Neon Tryst. You know, for those who don't know much about ekphrastic poetry or who maybe, you know, folks who don't think a lot about film and poetry, can you talk a little bit about the concept behind the book?
Yeah, sure. I started working on A Neon Tryst in 2006, actually. I just watched the film Seconds, which is a John Frankenheimer film. And if anybody had not seen it yet, please do. It's just a fabulous homage to Hitchcock. I think Frankenheimer's homage to Hitchcock. And it's a great noir film about a suicide, a man who fakes his own death and then lives a new life. But how it started was simply I started watching films I'd always wanted to see and just started writing to each movie as if I were the director. Each one of the sections of Neon Tryst, there's three films total that I address in the book. And each one of them existed separately as a manuscript. And then I started to realize after watching these films and then going back and writing to them, that there was a running thread or theme through all of the movies. And that was a sense of lost identity. The other two films that are featured in the book are Wild Strawberries. This is Ingmar Bergman's classic film. And Lake Cliss, which is Antonioni's part of a trilogy that he made with, I believe, La Ventura was the other film in the trilogy, and Red Desert. So basically, my love of film drove me to this, and then I compiled things over time and then realized this could be a full manuscript. because of the shared theme.
So this began as really separate manuscripts inspired by L'Eclisse, Seconds, and Wild Strawberries, and then you saw there was this bridge among all three and it could make it into one manuscript.
Exactly. I'd been working on kind of running through and editing each one separately and realized, you know what, all of these three protagonists have something in common. They're both kind of, I think all protagonists in all movies are searching for themselves to some extent, but these specifically kind of called out to me as unified in that way.
Yeah, and I think when you read the book, when you first see what the concept is, and so you read the back of the book and you get a sense of where the book will go, you know, my gut reaction was, okay, it's going to be really interesting to see how these three are going to be stitched together. And then, you know, somewhere halfway through, you know, maybe the second section, it's starting to become really clear. And I think that's one of the many strengths of the book is that these three films that might not look like they have a lot in common, by the time I'm done, I feel like, oh yeah, they belong together in this book. They have this communal relationship with each other.
Yeah, they're all very, it's interesting too, the films are all very stylistically different. All three directors completely come from a different angle or direction. But they're all dealing primarily with this notion that their characters have lost some sense of themselves and are grappling for that. And so I found that really, really interesting too. I didn't think that these three films would ever, you know, dance together in a single manuscript or a single book, and yet that here they are.
And they dance together. I like that.
Yeah, they all dance together, yes.
I'm thinking a little bit about the process too, as you're talking, the process of writing the book. And, Jill Maggie said in her blurb for the book, she said, it's like you're watching for the poem in the film. I think that's a great way of thinking about the book, because as I was reading it, I felt like each poem was sitting on the page like a separate film frame.
Yeah, it's cool that you picked that up, because I think I was looking at each poem as a scene, you know, so to speak, as if, like, again, going back to thinking I was the director in each scenario and figuring out how I would film the scene. So each poem is a scene and speaks to a scene, but I would cut it where I thought it should be cut, or I would rewrite it the way I felt it should have been presented. So it was kind of a fun exercise.
Yeah, and I can see how that translates to film so nicely. Like each poem is like a mini scene in a film, and then as the director, you have to find this place where if you cut it in the right spot, the poetry, it's going to be like a poem rather than just one unfolding narrative, just rather than just a vignette, it becomes a poem.
Right, and interestingly too, I was just thinking of this the other day. I was watching Martin Scorsese did a great special about different films. And one of the things that he does talk about specifically in addressing Antonioni's trilogy, the films that I described, was that L'Eclisse is actually one long poem. And that's an actual quote from Scorsese. So as soon as I heard that, I thought, yeah, no, this is accurate. There is some inextricable link between poem and film here.
Thinking about that Scorsese quote, which I think is really perfect for the book, I end up thinking more about ekphrastic poetry, and I really appreciate how A Neon Tryst avoids the kind of obvious ekphrastic moves. Like, and for me, what I mean like by the obvious moves are like where the poet, it's usually paintings the poet is writing about, where the poet writes about the painting and just gives us a synopsis of it, just sort of like recreates the visual composition of the painting in the poem. And when I read that sort of thing, I feel like, well, you know, I can get this from the poetry in the painting. It doesn't feel like a companion to the painting, but I really feel like, you know, the poems in A Neon Tryst are companions to the poetry of the films.
Yeah, I'm glad that you picked that up too, because one of the things that kind of perturbs me about ekphrastic poetry is that very notion that you were describing, or the very activity of just kind of explaining or re-explaining what just happened in the scene. And I really made a conscious effort when I went back to do this, was I did a few takes, if you will.
Yes.
I wrote the poems as a direct, you know, kind of response or mirror to that scene. And then I would take that again and then break it down further and break it down. And then that's where kind of the poetry alchemy would happen. But yeah, I think that when we think about ekphrastic poetry, and we write ekphrastic poetry, the trap is always that, you know, we tend to read poems by people writing to different art forms in this very narrative, linear, you know, response kind of way. Like, here it is. Oh, this is what I saw. You know, I saw this, and now I'm going to tell you what I saw. It gets kind of tricky to do it, but thank you. I appreciate that you got that.
Yeah, and I get perturbed by that sort of, you know, the predictable ekphrastic moves too. I think perturbed is the word. It's just like, you don't get angry, you just get a little buzzing annoyance, like, oh, not another one of these.
Well, you've seen it, like, you know, especially if people have seen the film, or, you know, if they've seen the painting, or, you know, whatever art form you're responding to, it's kind of like, yeah, I've seen that, you know, tell me something else. It's the bringing your own perspective to it.
Knowing that could be a trap. It sounds like you, the very first take, you just engaged the film and engaged the scene. And if you were in the trap, you were in the trap. So be it. You knew that there were going to be several takes until you avoided the trap.
Right. And several drinks of wine as well.
And several drinks of wine. Exactly.
You know what? After drinking a few, you know, glasses of wine, then that's where the magic happens, right?
Well, you know, and filmmakers, what directors have a giant crew to collaborate with. And maybe as poets, we just have a glass of wine sometimes. That's our collaborator.
Exactly. That's our, that's who we go to help us cut down some of the scenes, right?
Exactly. You know, in a second, I'd like us to hear a poem from the book, but as we're talking about the poetry in the films, a question kept coming up, it's really a speculative question, but like, these are amazing films in and of themselves. And do you think we can write ekphrastic poems about bad films? Like, could we have a Neon Tryst come from like three really bad Hollywood films? Or do you think, you know, the film itself has to have the poetry first before we can actually have poems from it?
That is a really great question. And I would say, yes, you probably could write to bad films. As a matter of fact, that would be an interesting exercise, I think. I mean, like, let's watch Earth Girls Are Easy and then write poems to it. I definitely think that you can do that. I mean, think about it. I mean, if it's one art form and it exists as it is, bad or good, you can still respond to it, you know? So, I mean, I would love to see stuff like that. I mean, actually, that might be my next project.
Yeah, it would be the flip side of a neon tryst. I don't know what, like, neon, like, you know, a polyester triptych. Maybe that's right. What it would be called.
And Ishtar would be in there, and there'd be some real classic, bad movies.
There's just so many amazing, as we were talking, I was thinking, okay, yeah, someone should write poems on like Mission Impossible 3 and The Hangover, and let's just see where it goes.
See where that goes.
Yeah, like just.
I guess you could cull some interesting poetry out of it, though. I mean, think about it. Even if you're watching the movie and you do the initial exercise of just retelling it, you could get some interesting dialogue, and I even do like a flarfy thing where you're just doing found quotes or poems and pulling out those aspects of the dialogue.
Yeah, if you took pieces of dialogue totally out of context, there can be poetry in that dialogue. It's just that it gets ruined when it's in the context of Mission Impossible 3.
Exactly. but all the more surprising if the poetry is good and they find out the source. So
exactly, that would be a fantastic surprise for a reader.
Yeah.
Well, let's hear a poem from the book.
Absolutely. So I'm going to read a poem from the second part of the book. Is I've actually had subtitles for each section of the book as well. So the second part of the book is to the film Seconds, and I titled it Wilson 722 because in the film, that's the pseudonym they give him, the alias they give him, the Rock Hudson character in this film. So should I go ahead and just read the small synopsis of what the film is about?
Yeah, why don't you do that and then just jump right into the poem. Yeah.
Okay. So Seconds was made in 1966, and it starred Rock Hudson as an aging, bored East Coast man who is encouraged to commit suicide by an ominous group of wealthy men called The Company. And after being framed by The Company, he's doped up and he's actually filmed raping a girl. He literally becomes, via reconstructive surgery, a new person. So his new identity is this hip, young, emerging artist who resides in a beach house on the California coast. And it offers him fabulous opportunities like women and parties and acceptance and all of this adulation, however, catches up to him, and then he is found out. And then as punishment, he has to go back to his old life. So it's really interesting how the story unfolds. I'm going to read, I'll read two poems from it.
That sounds great.
The first one is called I Love This Nude from a Distance. The question of death selection may be the most important in your life. Impaled by rain, the memory of dinner, of flesh, of stitches, all have a rubber hunger. Indelicate questions and a Roquefort complexion, the circumstances of your death must be simple. The trick lies in obliterating just so much and no more. You collect collarbone vignettes, cigarettes, pirouettes. Your city, an entire impervious velvet instrument of certified endings and logarithms. We guarantee a death of this kind, an explosion, a hunting misadventure, a hotel room fire. I cannot change who I am, only who I am when I have changed myself. Note, this chicken is delicious. This one is called Sign Here. A struggle in the soul of a good man wasn't that hard. A struggle in the soul of a good man shows no diagrams. Smells of youth becoming rock, chiseled and planned, injected, conglomerate. The tin clamor cleansing of instruments. I cannot breathe, my mouth sewn and milestone teeth ground as an obituary. When I soon prance around like a stud bull, but my vocal cords, that's what hurts most right now. This is called Hematoma. And as these poems progress, I mean, yeah, the story is sort of unfolding. So we get to know the character as well. And sort of there is dialogue sprinkled in, of course, in a lot of the poems as well. Hematoma. Get me to where I need to be. Condition my muscle and signature. I want a ball, a big, big red one. Abroad, my pictures are realistic in treatment, but deal with poetic imagery in choice of subject. False artisan, call me a cutlet of my throat, grunt me a wish to be old again. Do I know a brush as well as my own loneliness? I am forged, already established, mildly successful, surreal, primitive, impressionist. Whatever. I am accepted.
That was Lina Ramona Witkowskis reading from her new book, A Neon Tryst, on Radio Free Albion. The book is, you know, on one hand, we could look at the book as, you know, a series of ekphrastic poems, really with the, you know, the unusual ekphrastic poem, not the paraphrase ekphrastic poem, not the trap we were talking about. And that's one way to see the book, and I think that's excellent. We could also see the book as an incredible exercise in the short poem. And I love the short poems in the book. And by short, I'm thinking like, I don't know, 15 lines or less. Can you talk a little bit about what the allure of the short poem was for you in the book?
Yeah, actually, I think it was more a question or it was more a matter of just what the form or what the poem demanded at the time. So I found myself initially wanting to write, of course, larger pieces or poems. But as I hacked apart, you know, the initial poems that I wrote to the films, I realized that these work better as these sort of pop out vignettes, these quick little bursts, if you will, throughout. I felt that if I went too long with some of these, they would lose their impact. So I think the shorter form works in that respect.
They pop out and they burst. Exactly. Yeah, and I'm sure, I mean, you talked about cutting a lot and you know, it's always tough putting a book together. There are poems we're very attached to that we just have to let go. And I'm sure that had to be the case with the shorter poems, with sections of the shorter poems. You begin with a longer take and then leave a lot of the language on the cutting room floor.
Right. That's exactly right. I mean, I think it just was a matter of what do I really want to say? And am I saying it in the most effective way? And again, in the most true way to the film, at least the way that I view the film, again, from that fictitious director perspective.
And, you know, considering that from that perspective, you're taking on so many different voices. I'm wondering where the you is in the book. Like when you're not Monica Vitti or Rock Hudson, when are you Lina? Or are you ever Lina in the book?
Interesting. I don't know. I think there are a few poems actually where I pop in. There is a poem in the section of seconds where Rock Hudson is like in the middle of an orgy. where he's kind of, you know, in this crazy 60s party with these women, and they're all stomping on grapes in this huge vat of grapes. And I think I had a bloody nose in the middle of one of these poems, and I wrote that in there. So yeah, the Lina came in, you know, in these moments where, you know, it was like, that's right, this isn't a movie. I'm writing this poem and I'm in this film, but I'm not in this film. I'm watching this film as the observer. So yeah, I think that it just kind of comes in the most unexpected ways, but every once in a while, I think I sort of sneak myself in there.
Yeah, in this film, I have a bloody nose.
Yeah.
You know, I'm thinking about Seconds, and I do you know the story? And I just found out the story recently of Brian Wilson from the Beach Boys getting freaked out by the film.
Yeah, you know, I read something about that online, and I what exactly happened though? I mean, he watched the film. Obviously, Brian Wilson was had taken a lot of drugs, so.
And it's funny, you know, I was just about to say, well, I think he was tripping, and then I thought, well, isn't that obvious to say about Brian Wilson getting freaked out?
Yeah,
he had taken a lot of drugs, and you know, I know he had his own issues of mental stability, and you know, even independent of the drugs. And I think he started watching the film, and he thought it was actually speaking to him, and yeah, that he came in late, and the first dialogue he heard on the screen was "Come in, Mr. Wilson."
So, yeah,
poor guy.
Wilson is the alter ego. Arthur Hamilton is the man who commits suicide, and then he becomes Wilson. And yeah, it's pretty bizarre that he would have walked in on that moment.
It's so nice to have you know, a non-typical last name. So like, no one's in a film is going to say, "Come in, Mr. Trujillo," or "Come in, Ms. Witkowskis." I don't know if that's going to happen in an American film.
No, exactly. But I've had weird coincidences though, where I walked into films and something I just said, it was actually, you know, spoken in dialogue, not soon after on the screen. So it's weirder things have happened too. So.
Yeah, and I think that makes the Brian Wilson story even more creepy to me. Like, that has happened, and no one said my name, which would really put a chill down my spine. But, you know, those weird moments of synchronicity with films are really great after you kind of get your wits back. Yeah.
There's a scene in Diner that I'm thinking of the Barry Levinson film Diner, where I think it's the Mickey Rourke character that scene is trying to go further with this girl, and the dialogue in the movie, I think, is what is the movie with Doris Day where she's on the Sweet Hereafter? What is the movie? I can't remember, but where she's on the beach and they kiss on the beach. It's that famous scene, but the dialogue in the movie is actually mirroring back what they're talking about in the theater. And then later in that film, Barry Levinson does this quite well, I think, as a director. There's a scene where Tim Daly's character is having a very serious discussion about a girl he just got pregnant. And there's a conversation, and she works at a TV studio. And so the dialogue going on the TV is mirroring what they're talking about, or in direct opposition to.
Oh.
Very interesting.
Oh, that's great. And I did a really quick, in case, I don't know if the clicking will show up in the recording, but I was doing a really quick online search to see if I could find the name of that film. And I just couldn't, unfortunately. Doris Day film.
I can't remember it, but I believe it was Doris Day, and maybe it was even Rock Hudson. I can't remember, but it's a very famous scene where, you know, they kiss on the beach and the wave comes and washes over them, but that's the film that they're watching, but then he's trying to like get with her, and it's just a really interesting way the director decided to use that sort of mirroring technique of dialogue back and forth.
Maybe we could just call that film Spiny Retinas. I want to talk a little bit about the book that's coming out next year. So can you tell us a little bit about Spiny Retinas? I know it's a long poem, then, an epic poem.
It is. And I'm actually calling up the description for you so that I can actually read this to you because I can explain it, but then I end up getting myself all twisted up when I even try to explain it. Well, what it was a project I've worked on for a long time. It started with an episode of I Dream of Jeannie.
That's great. Okay. Let's go from there.
I love the characters of using the perspective of. I was going to write a short story actually using the characters the major, the general, and everybody would have these general titles, the cardinal, it started to get me thinking, and I think at the same time I was reading John Ashbery's Girls on the Run. And so I think his way of responding to Henry Darger's artwork and the way that I was responding to this I Dream of Jeannie film all kind of like merged together in this amalgam in my brain. I started writing a story, and then it turned into a poem because it was the way I was writing wasn't necessarily linear or narrative. It just kind of took its own, all the images took their own course, all the ideas took their own course. So there is a definitive, it's epic poem in the sense that it is like one long poem or it's a story, it's a collective piece, but it was an interesting experiment because I took, again, different inspiration from different sources, a television of a pop culture television show and a book that I by a poet I respect and admire greatly, and his turns of phrase and languages, and I just kind of sat down with it and just plowed through it. So now I'm at a point with the editor of the press, and we're just kind of combing through the last minute details of trying to tighten it up a little bit so that it does kind of stand it as a cohesive piece.
When you mentioned I Dream of Jeannie, I had this very concise, the half hour, the beginning and end bounded half hour narrative in my head. And then you went to Ashbery's Girls on the Run, and I suddenly thought, oh, I've got the half hour bounded narrative. And then suddenly I'm in the meandering John Ashbery world. And that's a fantastic fusion. It's more of a collision than a fusion. It's great.
Yeah, it was, and to tell you quite honestly too, I think I usually read things in tandem. So one of the other things I was reading too at the time was Richard Brautigan's Trout Fishing in America. This very classic kind of storytelling format in this very kind of surreal way. So I actually use that as inspiration too. But yeah, I think it's a collision. That's a good way to put it. It's taking from all the things you're kind of reading and seeing and kind of taking in. With your senses, and then kind of mi mixing it up on the page and see what happens.
And so this is going to come out, say, early next year, or do you have like a publication date or anything, an idea of when it might be coming out?
Yeah, I'm actually working with the press right now in terms of pinning down an exact date. It looks like tw they're saying fall of 2014, but we're hoping it will be probably earlier than that.
Great. Okay. Well, we'll look forward to that. And that's coming out from Mutable
Mutable.
Sound.
Mutable sound.
So let's hear a couple more poems from A Neon Tryst.
Sure. I'll go ahead and delve into a second portion of the book, which is from the film Les Eclisses, which is the Antonioni film. This particular section of the book is titled Black Patent Translations. For those who have not seen the movie, Les Eclisses was made in 1962, and it stars who I call the sleek, silver, hypnotic Monica Vitti. If nobody has ever seen Monica Vitti, Google image search her. She is the most gorgeous woman. But she plays a lost woman rediscovering herself after leaving her husband. And then she cavorts with friends around town and she mingles with men on the stock exchange trading floor. There's a lot of really great scenes Antonioni does, showing like this exchange of money and the men, and how they act around the money. And it's just a fantastic display. But so she mingles with the men on the stock trading floor and I noted here that this is perhaps Antonioni's metaphor for self-worth. She has an affair with a younger man who is a stockbroker of some sort, and she abandons him. And it's this very vague, unclear future for her in this new life after she's left her husband. But everything in this film is very pure, fluid Viti. She's doe-eyed, desperate, tortured, and sophisticated. So I wanted that to come out in these poems. The first poem I'll read is the first poem of the series, and it's called Meditation in Mirrors. She, Twin nude nun, mouths the moth wings of the fan, lips the sun in a slip. She repeats to herself the chronology of the mountain, outskirts the windows, paperweight stumps, cylindrical, trumpet-bodied vases. She is not, she paces, drawn to him, but poorly formed away from him. The architecture of the room, the hamlet in the portrait, she, edible species, seeks ideals, loves gigantic stalk. I'll move on to the next scene. I'm actually going a little further into a scene which is actually really beautifully filmed. It's when she's actually wandering in the town in the night. And there's some great classic Italian village scenes in this movie, and this is one of them. This is called The Unwilling Foundation. Poles create angles. Help me mend this parachute. The doors of Nimbus Stratus, Colosseum against propeller. She is found on the ground, eyeing a metal arc, all askew and unfamiliar. But you, ciao, you are new.
You've been listening to Lina Ramona Vitkauskas on Radio Free Albion. Her most recent book is A Neon Tryst, which was published in 2013 by Shearsman. It's available everywhere you'd like to buy books online, including independent sites like Small Press Distribution, spdbooks.org, and at bookstores that carry books of poetry from independent presses. Keep an eye out, too, for her book Spiny Retinas, which will be published in 2014 by Mutable Sound. You also can get to know Lina and her work more by visiting her website, linaramona.com. That's one word, linaramona.com. Thanks for coming on the show, Lina. It was great talking with you.
Oh, this was great. Thanks so much, Tony, for having me.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Albion. If you want to email me and tell me what you thought of today's show, you can get in touch with me at radiofreealbion@gmail.com. That's one word, radiofreealbion@gmail.com. You can also go to the show's Twitter page, twitter.com/radiofreealbion. Thanks again for listening.